Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
From Brett's Wildlife Lodge and Winery in Southern Illinois, I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you today from Carlisle, where I'm traveling with the Illinois Farm Economics Summits. We'll discuss the commodity markets, of course, on this Thursday with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Jonathan Kappas, agricultural policy specialist, will be here to go through the tax bill that was just passed by Congress, the potential implications it and other bills that are moving through the Hill might have on the farm policies of the United States over the next several weeks, and we'll also take a look at what's been happening in the cash grain market. We'll talk with Matt Bennett of Bennett Consulting, Channel Seeds out of Windsor, Illinois, and we'll do all of that right here on this 21st day of December edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, no update of the numbers as they've been trading in Chicago for this Thursday. However, a quick reminder, the Commodity Week will be recorded this afternoon. Our panelists should include Dale Durkles from AgriVisor, along with Chuck Shelby from Risk Management Commodities, and Joe Vaklevic of Standard Grain. So be sure to visit our website at willag.org, willag.org. We'll update that by about 5 o'clock this evening. You can hear that program tomorrow afternoon on this radio station. And then over the weekend on many of these radio stations as well. Again, willag.org for this afternoon. If you'd like to listen to Commodity Week, our panelists this week will include Chuck Shelby, Dale Durkles, and Joe Vaklevic. The other item of interest is if you want to visit with the farm agricultural economist from the University of Illinois, you have one more opportunity to do that. That's tomorrow, Friday, at the I Hotel and Conference Center in Champaign County at 7:45 a.m. We will open the doors for registration. The cost is $75. Your chance to visit with us and talk about the commodity markets, farm policy, the financial health of the farm right here in the state of Illinois, the Illinois Farm Economic Summit. You can see all the details on our website at willag.org, willag.org. Or you can visit the Farm Doc Daily website. The address there is farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for Urbana-Champaign this evening. Patchy drizzle, cloudy with a low of 38 degrees tonight. East southeast winds at 5 to 7. They'll turn to the northwest after midnight. That'll bring us some cloudy skies, a high of 45 for Friday. North-northwest winds then at 5 to 7 miles an hour Friday evening. It'll be cloudy, a low of 32. North-northwest winds at 6 to 8. And on Saturday, cloudy, then becoming mostly sunny, a high of 36 degrees for Saturday. North-northwest northwest winds at 8 to 10 miles an hour. Saturday evening, mostly cloudy, will drop to a low of just 20 degrees. It'll be cold out there with that north-northwest wind at about 8 mile an hour. And then on Sunday, a 30% chance of snow after the noon hour. Partly sunny and a high of 31. West-northwest winds by then at 7 to 9. Looking into Sunday night, partly cloudy and 16 for Christmas Day. That's Monday, sunny and a high of 28. Monday evening, mostly cloudy and a low of 13 degrees. Partly sunny and a high of 26 for Tuesday. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy in the Urbana-Champaign area, low of 12. And on Wednesday, we'll go to a high of just 30 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. You can find all the details of the weather forecast on our website at willag.org. Look for the weather link. It's right there at willag.org. The Closing Market Report, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online again at willag.org. It's public radio for the farming world.
Thanks to everyone who attended the annual WILL Ag Assets Conference in Normal, Illinois. We appreciate your support.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for a Thursday afternoon. We're now joined by Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Good afternoon to you, Dan. Thanks so much for being with us. I'd like you to set the technical stage for the soybeans first for me, and then maybe follow up with corn, please.
Well, soybeans have been in a pretty steep, steadily grind lower since we made our highs, you know, back in early December. So December has been a decisive down move in futures. I think the last time I talked to you a week ago, we were kind of down at the bottom end of the of a sideways channel that I thought we were maybe going to stay in. Obviously, that was not the case. We have kind of broken out of that sideways channel, and now we're I suppose technicians now are looking at returning back to those August low points and see how much support we get there. Fundamentally, it's pretty much a South American market, and right at the moment, everybody seems to be generally comfortable with the short-range weather forecasts. I think some of the longer-range forecasts may be a little bit on the dry side, but they're going to kind of take 1 week at a time. And as long as things in South America go in a favorable direction, it'll be tough probably for soybeans to put together much of a rally. But when you look at all of the technical indicators, especially the momentum indicators, it would suggest that we should be nearing a point on the chart that the market could have some kind of recovery rally to kind of correct some of these oversold technical conditions. And that just might be the case that we're doing here going into a three-day weekend. We got one more day of trade left, and then we go into a three-day weekend. So we may begin to see some kind of bounce maybe on Friday. And then we'll see kind of what happens between, you know, Christmas and New Year's week. That's usually a light volume trade. Many times it's not surprising to see something come to the forefront and make the week a little more exciting than what most people expect.
And your view of the corn market?
Corn market, same old, same old. The last time I talked to you, December futures were trading. They went off the board that day. So we've been a week now with the March futures as the lead option, and it has been able to keep that lead futures chart gap kind of in place. And I think that's generally positive, or at least for right now. But for the most part, you got to call corn futures in a sideways range. The broad range is kind of like a 340, 360. We got March futures now, you know, in the 350, kind of in the middle part of that range. And I guess we're just waiting around for some kind of fundamental thing to come along to kind of change things. And the first would be, you know, problems maybe in South America, but at least for right now, there's really nothing on the burner that maybe really shake up the balance sheet. And I think that's probably what he's looking at. And that's why the market is kind of, you know, in a sideways trading pattern, waiting for something to happen to break out of that, whether or not it would be bullish or bearish. But my guess is we're just kind of waiting around to see what kind of crop South America has, and then what kind of spring planting season we're going to have, and whether or not we'll see any kind of drop in corn acres based upon the profitability picture of corn.
Any of your timings tell you that things will happen in the next several weeks?
Well, I'm kind of in the camp that we're maybe due for some kind of winter-spring rally. More probably springish, April, May, time frame. My cycles would indicate that that would probably be the best chance right now for a meaningful rally. And then the cycles, then if you have a spring high, then that when the market would turn down, it would probably turn down, you know, into the summer, and then we'll see, you know, what kind of growing season weather we have, whether or not we would bounce back and come in for a strong fall. But for right now, my guess is that we should see some price strength here late winter, springtime, and then we'll have to take the growing season, you know, kind of one week at a time. But that's kind of what my thinking is from a cyclical point of view.
Hey, Dan, thanks so much. We appreciate you being with us for the day.
Very well.
That's Dan Zwicker. He is with Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Well, again, we're traveling today with the Farm Doc Daily team in southern Illinois at Brett's Wildlife Facility. That's in Carlisle, Illinois. If you want to join us tomorrow, you can. That'll be the last in our series for the Illinois Farm Economics Summits. We'll be at the I Hotel tomorrow morning, 7:45 a.m. Registration opens there in Champaign County. The cost is $75, and walk-ins certainly are welcome. It's been a really good series, and it's been very well received. More good comments than I've heard in years, not that we ever have a bad farm series for the Farm Economics Series. It's just that folks like Jonathan Kappas, who's a farm policy specialist, have put together some really interesting content for the program. So you can join us tomorrow morning if you'd like. Jonathan actually is here this afternoon to talk with us a little bit about farm policy. However, this spans a whole bunch of legislation, and I'd like to know, Jonathan, I know you've taken a look at it. However, we still don't know a lot about what's in the tax bill that was just passed and signed into law by President Trump. Is there any immediate impact that you can see at this point on farmers and producers and small business owners?
Well, I think that's correct. I personally do not have a good sense of all the provisions within that bill. We know it cuts corporate tax rates. It's kind of the centerpiece of it, of a substantial cut to the corporate tax rate. Some different treatment on different, you know, aspects that might be of interest to farmers, but I frankly have not had the opportunity to dig into it to speak with any clarity. You know, the main thing I've looked at and have tried to begin thinking through, and it's one of the things we discuss here today, is outside of the tax changes itself, you know, what are the implications for other policy, other bills, other policy issues? And, of course, with a farm bill on the horizon, it raises a lot of those questions. So we've been talking about and try to think through a little bit of what that scenario looks like in the wake of this tax bill.
This tax bill, and I take it the disaster aid package that Congress is considering has some interesting tweaks to it that would be have an effect on farm policy as well.
Well, it's possible. Now, there's a lot that has changed in the course of just this week alone as we've gone from meeting to meeting. We've had to update a little bit of our perspective on it. You know, the House introduced early in the week this disaster and continuous resolution. First things first, the federal government's about ready to run out of money as early as tomorrow. And that would result in a shutdown over the holidays and obviously raise a lot of concerns. You know, they get the tax bill through and now they have to deal with continuing funding for the federal government. What the House proposed earlier in the week would also have attached hurricane disaster relief supplemental funding. So we would fund the government, we'd add a supplemental, I believe it was roughly $81 billion in disaster assistance. Interestingly enough, from a farm bill perspective, tucked within that disaster program was a change to the Farm Bill of 2014, which would add seed cotton back into, basically bring old cotton and base acres back into the ARC PLC program outside of the Farm Bill process.
Wait, so you stuttered through cotton seed because it's now called seed cotton. It has implications for many things. What are the most interesting implications at this point in your mind?
So yeah, you caught me as I try to keep the terminology straight, right? We previously provided assistance and support to cotton or upland cotton. That was pulled out in the last farm bill because of the WTO, because we lost that WTO dispute with Brazil. And then earlier this year, the Senate Agricultural Appropriations Bill included a provision that would add cotton seed as a covered commodity. So that would bring the base acres back in, but then trigger payments based on the price of cotton seed, which is a byproduct or of lint production. And then this most recent version has been modified further to something called seed cotton, which, as best we can tell, and we're still trying to analyze the actual legislative provisions, seed cotton is merely a combination of cotton lint and cotton seed, and they're just combining the two, which kind of leads back to the original point that really what any of these provisions are doing is taking the old upland cotton base that were turned into generic base and pulling it back into the program with a reference price to trigger payments. So ultimately it all gets to the same outcome. It's just a change in terminology, a change in how the reference price and the trigger prices would be calculated. The ultimate outcome, should this become law, now it sounds like as of yesterday maybe, that the House is pulling back on this altogether and is probably going to do just a straight continuing resolution and revisit the whole thing in the new year. So this may be yet just another test balloon that has popped in the process, and then we'll come back and start all over again in the new year. I don't fully know the outcomes. That what is key in this discussion, if we think longer term in Farm Bill, is that we knew the cotton industry wanted added back into Title I. In this Farm Bill process, and that doing so would have significant cost in the baseline. You know, very rough analysis of some of these ideas were in the billions of dollars. So with a baseline challenge to begin with, adding cotton seed into the program is going to come with a need for offsets. I mean, something else gets reduced to pay for cotton. So that's one of the reasons why we've been looking at this a lot and paying attention to it, because we're, you know, obviously Illinois doesn't have cotton base, but the concern is that adding cotton would require offsets from corn and soybean, or even worse, offsets from crop insurance. And so we've been watching it closely to keep track of what this means for Illinois farmers. Adding it outside of the Farm Bill process, while very unusual, actually very unprecedented to make this kind of change in an appropriations process, what it does on the upside is it would add it in to the baseline without having those costs charged against the ag committees in the Farm Bill process, because CBO will have to assume that that is now a part of the law when they do the next baseline. So they've found kind of almost a loophole in the budgetary discipline system that would allow them to bring the baseline in without being charged for it in the offset process technically. Now, what this does raise is a series of questions. Is if something like this happens outside of the Farm Bill, I mean, you know, does it add further pressure to cut spending elsewhere just because we've done this? Again, all of that being speculation at best.
Yeah, and it seems to me that speculation then would lead to things. The Farm Bill is consistent historically of farm programs and the food and nutrition programs. If you're outside of the Farm Bill, how much of it can be done, I guess, outside of the Farm Bill? Does the Farm Bill then, is it opened up all the time? Do you lose the potential to work across the aisle, across the urban and farm communities? This sounds like there are lots. It's a tricky road to walk down.
It is. I mean, I think the thing that is concerning, both from the tax bill, frankly, operating from the Farm Bill perspective, what is concerning from both the tax bill and this idea of adding, of exactly what you said, opening the Farm Bill outside the process and adding something to it or changing something permanently to that. The bigger concern, and we can argue about policy specifics, but the bigger concern becomes, what does this mean for the next step? So, for example, the tax bill likely adds $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion to the federal deficit over the next 10 years. So that's $100 billion to $150 billion a year in additional deficit. Congress is already making, some members of Congress are already talking about welfare reform. And that then kicks us into a discussion much like what we started in 2011 that resulted in the end of direct payments and other changes in the last Farm Bill and a three-year difficult process. Is a budget-focused or a sort of monomaniacal focus on cutting spending without a policy discussion around it. So now we start to say, we got to cut. Welfare reform is being talked about already as one of those processes. Once you get into that kind of discussion, the politics get extraordinarily difficult and make it really hard to sort of use the traditional bipartisan multi-regional farm bill coalition to get a bill done, largely because we now end up getting really wrapped around how much does SNAP get cut. And when you start taking huge changes and cuts to SNAP, you start losing a lot of votes, frankly, particularly in that center part of the coalition, and then it gets really hard to pass a bill. So something like this cotton, seed cotton issue, you're now adding another political layer into this, right? So if the conversation in a welfare reform discussion doesn't include Title I, which it would be surprising if it doesn't, adding seed cotton outside the process would seem to highlight too many of the budget cutters. And you've already seen the Heritage Foundation, for example, I think it was, or American Enterprise, one of those groups already pouncing on the seed cotton as a giveaway to farmers in a budget-tight environment. So you sort of help tee up the arguments of the opponents against these programs, and that helps to ensure they're caught up into the spending cut debate. And now we've got layers upon layers of political challenges.
The cynic in me tells me the longer-term end goal may be the belt tightening that would have to happen because of the process, and it would happen, relatively speaking, automatically unless they decided to fix the deficit spending in some other form.
Well, that's one of the things we talk about. And so technically speaking, by passing the tax bill, once it's signed into law, it sets in motion automatic across-the-board cuts, the sequestration cuts, to pay for the additional deficit created by this bill. That is technically what should happen. Congress is going to have to act to undo that. They're going to have to waive that sequestration in some form or fashion or eliminate it altogether because, frankly, the level of sequestration that it would require is either not, you just can't implement it, there's not enough to cut, or it would cut so deeply that it's politically unacceptable. The example you see a lot in the press on this is it would take somewhere around $25 billion out of Medicare. Now, that's just not acceptable to Congress. That's the kind of thing that you get a huge pushback. Another example is the Farm Bill. Farm programs, conservation programs, those things are subject to sequestration. The level of sequestration required by this tax bill would eliminate the baseline for the Farm Bill. It would eliminate Title I and much of Title II spending based on our analysis. These things are kind of absurd in operation, which means Congress is likely to fix it. But again, it adds fuel to these budget-cutting fires in the new year that now, well, we waived this, now we definitely got to come back and cut these programs. And so you can just kind of see the follow-on effects, the ripple effects of this tax bill in the other parts of the legislative process. And, you know, again, we've been through this in a Farm Bill debate, and so it does raise some red flags and concerns. Doesn't mean any of it's going to happen. I mean, Congress can certainly take different paths, and a Farm Bill could certainly find its way through the morass of all of this and get to the end goal relatively intact. It just, you know, we sort of do the old farmer mechanism of take the bad case scenario, start planning for it, start thinking through how do you avoid it or how do you work around it or how do you address and deal with the potential that this might happen.
Hey, thank you so much, Jonathan. Jonathan Kappas, of course, is an ag policy specialist here on campus. You can read more from Jonathan and the rest of the Ag Economist online at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu.
It's National French Fried Shrimp Day. In the U.S., shrimp harvesting was known as early as the 17th century in Louisiana, where bayou inhabitants used nets of up to 2,000 feet in circumference. By the way, it was not until 1917 that motorized boats used trawl nets to catch shrimp. On this day in agricultural history in 1620, Mayflower pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock on the western side of Cape Cod Bay. During the first winter, more than half of the settlers died as a result of poor nutrition and inadequate housing. But the colony survived due in part to Squanto, a native to the New World, who taught the pilgrims how to plant corn and where to fish and trap beaver. In 1773, Robert Brown was born. A Scottish botanist, he improved the natural classification of plants by establishing and defining new families. In 1829, the first stone arch railroad bridge in the U.S. was dedicated in Baltimore. Construction took over 9 months and involved some 1,500 tons of granite. Overall, the bridge stands 62 feet tall and is 300 feet long. In 1944, horse racing was banned in the U.S. until after World War II. And although it doesn't have much to do with agriculture, on this day in 1950, Bing Crosby's White Christmas topped the charts. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media for this Thursday afternoon. Mike Tenora is now here. He's with T-Storm out of Chicago, Illinois. Mike, thanks for being with us. Happy holidays to you, by the way. First, let's start in Argentina. They are expecting rainfall. Tell me about the amounts they'll get and what that might really mean in conjunction with the growing season.
Well, they will see a little bit more rain over the next couple of days. Say 1/4 of an inch to 3/4 of an inch in the central and southern areas where most corn and soybeans are grown, and then a little bit more as you head into the fringe areas further to the north. Now, they did see quite a bit of rain in a few different locations over the last 5 days. That included some of those key areas in the central region, which is where a majority of corn and soybeans are produced. But the one thing we need to keep in mind is that it was unusually dry leading into this period. 30-day rainfall deficits had mounted significantly over the last few weeks, and because of that, nearly the entire growing belt had been drier than normal over the most recent 30-day period leading into last weekend. Now, it has rained since, but if you look at some of these soil moisture charts that we keep track of, we just don't see a big drop in the coverage of dryness, and that's because it hasn't rained enough. We need more rain. Now, again, we will see a little rain here over the next couple of days, but then it dries out for about a week, which leads us into next weekend. Starting up next weekend, there will be a few thunderstorms around. At this point, we don't think those storms are going to be heavy, but they will, you know, aid a few different areas depending on exactly where they go. But by the time you put all this together, I think an argument can be made that we're still going to need more rain in January in these key farming areas of Argentina. So there will be something to watch there going forward. So just keep that in mind as we move into next year.
And if you move northward in South America, what do the conditions in Brazil look like?
Southern Brazil and Paraguay have been unusually dry over the last 2 to 3 weeks, but they're going to be the beneficiary of this weather pattern that's coming up. There will be a number of cool fronts moving into those areas, and that will help to produce thunderstorms from time to time. So in the end, we're looking for widespread coverage of near to above normal rainfall in these dry areas. That will help to alleviate the situation a little bit. But keep in mind, approximately 2/3 of first crop corn production and half of soybean production in Brazil were drier than normal over the last 2 weeks. So we actually do need some of this rain. Again, with this rain in the forecast, it kind of takes away what would be a potential story going forward. So we'll see how these things pan out. But at this point, Brazil should be looking a little better than Argentina once we get into January.
Tell me about the Arctic cold in the United States and what we'll be looking forward to next week.
Well, we'll be looking forward to a lot of cold weather. It will certainly feel a lot more like Christmas once we get into next week. Temperatures will be dropping quite a bit here Friday and Saturday. And then after that, a couple more cold fronts move through. One of the big questions, and we're not sure how this is going to work out yet, we can see that there's going to be a very sharp dividing line between Arctic cold and relatively mild air to the immediate south. Illinois will be on the cold side, but this sets the stage for a pretty big winter storm somewhere in the central or eastern United States in about 7 to 10 days from now. Not a certainty, but certainly something to watch. a lot of the ingredients are there for this to come together. Whether or not they will is what will follow going forward.
Hey, Mike, thanks so much, and you have a very good holiday season. Of course, Mike Tenor is with T-Storm Weather. He's out of Chicago. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.